Good afternoon, and welcome to Boldness on 3CR, 8:55 AM, Radical Radio, on Wednesday, the 16th of July. My name is Rafael Caleb, and today, with the Boldness is talking about disability from a lived experience perspective of disability, so people get the right information from their peers, their fellows, to make sure we all know that with what we're doing. Now, on today's show, we're talking about economic justice for people with a disability. It's a panel discussion today. And so we've got three extremely important people. And Sherry, would you please introduce yourself?
Thanks, Raf, and thank you so much for having me here today. I am Dr. Sherry Belosis. I am the Director of Policy and Advocacy at DANA, the Disability Advocacy Network Australia.
Thanks very much, Sherry. Tennille, would you please introduce yourself?
Thanks, Raf. Hi, everyone. My name's Tennille Lamb. I am a Kanaloo Warrable woman from Central Queensland, and I am the Director of Strategy and Policy at the First Peoples Disability Network.
Right. And Daryl, would you please introduce yourself?
Thanks, Raf. Yeah, my name is Daryl Steph, and I'm the CEO of Down Syndrome Australia. We're a disability representative organisation that represents people with intellectual disability and their families.
Right. Now, so this is a really important topic. It's a hot topic, economic justice for people with a disability. In general terms, people with a disability often face more additional challenges than other people with the amount of income they have, the resources that are actually available, can be very, very difficult. Now, from an economic justice perspective, a quick lead-in is that, for example, where I rent through, which is in community housing, the way I was able to get my first couple of weeks' rent was actually my youngest son in his 30s paid it for me. It wouldn't have been possible otherwise. Now, what does economic justice mean to Sherry?
Thank you, Raf. To me, economic justice looks at the fairer distribution of resources. And I'm not just talking about financial resources. I'm talking about information, access to services, and knowledge as well. And looking at the ways that the types of injustices that are interrelated to that impact and compound each other. So in our economic blueprint, we look at income support, employment, and housing. And I think it's quite hard if we take the lens of economic justice to look at them separately, but we have for the purpose of our blueprint, because they're all interrelated and they all impact on each other. And I think they are a very good representation of how the distribution of resources are uneven for people with disability.
Now, Tennille, now, what are your thoughts? Would you like to expand on that? Or can you think of examples of economic justices that you're aware of, economic injustices that you've come across?
Yeah, thanks, Raf, and thanks, Sherry. I think I would like to just expand on what Sherry was talking about from the perspective of First Nations people with disabilities. So often our people face the intersection of racism and ableism in this country, and often face a double disadvantage. So, for example, if we look at public housing in remote communities, we know that quite often public housing stock is not up to standard and it's quite not often maintained as well as it should be, let alone have disability inclusive features. So quite often we'll find elders in remote communities and people in remote communities who can't either leave the house because maybe they use a wheelchair or they can't get into it. It's quite often not accessible. The other thing is, in remote communities, you'll find that food security is a really big issue as well. So even if you can afford rent, then I don't know how you're going to afford an $11 lettuce, as an example, let alone more substantive food. And you'll often find elders with disabilities who give their families food before they feed themselves. So that's kind of what we're looking at from an Indigenous perspective, is looking at the intersection and where our people face both racism and ableism and trying to overcome those.
Now, Daryl, let's hear from your thoughts about economic justice, what it means, and a couple of practical examples.
Yeah, thanks, Raf. I support everything that Sherry and Tennille have said. I think to give you a couple of practical examples, in the employment sense, often for someone with an intellectual disability, they might have to face the choice of being offered a job that pays below the minimum wage, which can be as low as $3 an hour, just because they have a disability. So do they take that job just so that they have something to do and some income, or do they not take that job and end up being, you know, potentially isolated, stuck at home and obviously struggling financially with wages like that? And another one, building on some of Tennille's comments, is around housing. Many people with disability have to make decisions whether to actually stay living with family because accessible, affordable housing isn't available, or their only choice is, particularly for people with intellectual disability, might be to live in a group home or a segregated setting. And I think, you know, those are the daily realities for millions of Australians with disability. There's one in five Australians living with disability. And what we're saying with the economic justice is that those people deserve the same options and access to economic security as everybody else. And it's not just something we're asking for because, you know, because it's nice to have. It's actually a right. It's their right under international and Australian law. And so that's why we're pushing for this economic justice.
Look. Raf, do you mind if I just offer one more example?
And
I just
course, really want to. Of course, of course.
Thank you. I just wanted to raise this because it's so topical right now, but because it's such a critical example, is the example of Kumanjayi White, who we all know passed away in police custody just recently in Alice Springs. Kumanjayi White had a severe and profound disability, who wasn't able to live at home with his community because of his disability, had to live in a home in Alice Springs. He was detained by police because it appeared that he had taken some food from the supermarket. We all know it's not a crime to be hungry, so we don't know exactly what the circumstances were as to why he felt the need to take the food, but he ended up paying the price with his life. And I think the economic injustice in this situation has so many multiple factors, of the fact that he couldn't live at home with his community because of his disability. He was in a group home. His family weren't with him. The police didn't stop to talk to him and de-escalate the situation, and ended up taking his life. And I think it's just critical that, you know, as a nation and governments and the police force, we need to start looking at these issues very seriously, and de-escalating situations, but also doing something to prevent them from happening in the first place.
Look, these are all fantastic points, and we've actually gone through a whole lot of information there, and letting this into what income support actually is. Now, the point, let's say, around living in remote communities, does this mean should we have tiers of, let's say, a disability support pension? And even with, you know, the National Disability Insurance Scheme, that in Australia there's around 5 million people that identify as having a disability. It's actually more if people are going to include the deaf and hard of hearing community, it then goes up to around 8 million, but that is a separate thing. The perspective I come from, with the National Disability Insurance Scheme, only around 10% of people with a disability in Australia are eligible as assessments for the National Disability Insurance Scheme. What are your thoughts, starting with Tennille?
Yeah, thanks, Raf. And I think you'll find as well that even less of the Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander population with disabilities have access to or on the NDIS as well. I think, and that has also a lot to do with how our people look upon disability, but also general perceptions around the NDIS and if it's a good thing to be on and if they're going to get the supports that they need. And in remote regional and rural and remote communities, we know that because the NDIS operates on a market-based model, services just aren't available in rural and remote areas. The market doesn't operate out there. There is no market. So it's just not working for our people in so many respects. Yeah. Thanks, Raf.
And now, Daryl, you're now in the elevated position of number two. Let's hear from your thoughts about income support.
Yeah, thanks, Raf. To your point around the number of people with disability in Australia in total versus, you know, those on the NDIS, I think just to touch on that before I get onto income support, you raise a really important point there around the foundational supports that the government has been talking about for the last 18 months or so, and there is still that black hole as to what those actually look like, because that is kind of the key element to understanding what some of those broader disability supports for those people who aren't on the NDIS could look like. So that's obviously one thing that we're really keen during this next period of government to have some clarity on. But in terms of income support, you're right, the disability support pension is probably one of the key areas we focus on here, and it is an essential economic foundation that enables people with disability to meet their needs and participate in life, but unfortunately it doesn't meet the costs of disability and provide the security that's required. And the other thing that it does, particularly in the context of employment, and employment of people with intellectual disability, is it can actually act as a barrier to employment. So there are people with who won't take on more hours or won't take a higher paid role because they are scared of losing access to their disability support pension. And often that's not just the access to the dollars of the pension, but it's the access to the other benefits such as the healthcare cards that come with it, which actually do provide some relief to some of the costs associated with disability. So, you know, that pension does need to be reformed, A, so that it's at a rate that lifts people out of poverty, and B, that it operates in such a way that it doesn't continue to be a barrier to further employment.
Now, Sherry.
Thanks, Daryl and Tennille. I agree with the points that they've raised. The disability support pension is a key element in providing financial support. I also think alongside that, we need to look at JobSeeker and Newstart. The rates of those types of support are so incredibly low that it elevates the risk for people to become entrapped in poverty. I know that Tennille spoke about living in regional rural areas. To access the DSP can be exceptionally hard to meet the evidentiary threshold. I also want to touch on the intersectionality of the experience, the different experiences culturally of disability as well, which can act as a barrier. So I come from a migrant family. I'm a person of colour. My family had severe mental illness, and there was a lot of shame. So I think accessing services was quite difficult to move beyond that shame within the community. So I think there is a potentially vulnerable group of people when we look at the intersecting levels of economic disadvantage that can get entrapped on different types of income support, such as JobSeeker. And I've seen it happen in my own family. And I see this happen with some of our members as well. So we, as a member organisation, support independent advocacy organisations, and we can see the difficulties, particularly in regional and rural remote areas, where lifting people out of a cycle of poverty is an issue due to systems surrounding people not providing the adequate support to lift them out of that.
Yeah, but look, there's something which I think is around income support. When it comes down to, let's say, people who are in partnered situations with people with a disability, if they happen to be on the disability support pension, their partner's income can actually wipe it out. And I'm going to actually come across, bring this into, let's say, stigma, and I will ask, I'll ask Sherry
Sorry, I was jumping out of my seat then.
In a second, but while I've actually got the floor here, that, for example, that let's say same-sex marriages, LGBTQIA plus communities, for example, in the disability community, there is a much higher percentage of people with a disability who identify as being in an LGBTQIA plus community. I think it's around 15%, which is significantly higher, and it creates a microaggression or major aggression against people with a disability for the right for them to have self-determination with their incomes. And Sherry, I know that you're dying to jump in. Let's hear from you.
Oh, I'm sorry. I think I was still stuck on a previous point, which was, yeah, okay, and then I can try and answer this question. So I was just thinking through that there are hidden costs of disability, which I don't think income support adequately addresses. So particularly, again, living out in regional rural areas, the need to travel, medication, accessing specialist supports in thin markets, where sometimes there are monopolies of different service providers that can, you know, charge through the roof. Coming back to your point around self-determination and partnerships, that's absolutely right. I think it's so important for people to be seen as individuals and not have their income affected by the, you know, them being identified as being in a partnership, which can then lower their financial resources.
Look, and again, I'm going to make it we better post some community service announcements, and let's continue the discussion around income supports. We're going very in-depth, some great information. So let's hear some community service announcements, and just remember, it is Radiothon time. Jaspine, we will happily still take any kind of donations, and let's just play them very quickly now. Welcome back to the Boldness on the 16th of July, which incidentally is Disability Pride Month. And we're talking about economic justice for people with a disability and economic blueprint. I have got Dr. Sherry from the Disability Advocacy National Australia, Tennille Lamb, and Daryl Staff as well. And they're all leaders in their actual organisation. And we've been talking about income support, and it's something which disability, I don't believe, actually discriminates in the community as far as who may have a disability, acquired disabilities, congenital disabilities. And when it comes down to things like income support, let's say if a person happened to have a congenital disability or an acquired disability and they were a family of maybe some influence, they could legally protect themselves to show that they've actually got a much lower income, which is one of those hidden costs of having an equitable income for people with a disability. Daryl, how would you like to tackle that one?
That's an interesting one, Raf. I think, look, I mean, the income support system, whether for people with disability, as we've touched on, there's a number of different aspects to it. There's the disability support pension, there's related payments, the other related worker payments. And I think the problem with all of them is that they keep people below the poverty line. And so that's the key thing that needs to be addressed, is that they need to be brought up to a level that actually doesn't mean that back to your point, Raf, doesn't mean that people look to manipulate income or whatever it might be, because the actual payments are at a reasonable level in the first place that actually allow people to access the supports and services they need. Recognize the cost of disability, and both Tennille and Sherry have touched on some of the costs that aren't always thought about in terms of people with disability. And I think that's the important thing. And and the other aspect of income support is to pay people with disability a fair wage for the work they're doing. So one of the other parts of our economic blueprint campaign is about that equal pay for equal work, which is a basic right which is denied to many people with disability, and currently for Australia to have a system where people can be paid as low as $3 an hour is discriminatory and a breach of people's rights. So we need to find a pathway to phasing out those sub-minimum wages and raising those income support payments.
Neil, you're nodding your head. You're on the spot here. Thoughts?
100%. I agree with everything that Daryl has just said. And yeah, it is outrageous. I think that as a country in as such as Australia in 2025, who we hold up ourselves as a leader in human rights, that we are paying people with disability $3 an hour for their work. It is just the most outrageous thing. And yeah, the system is designed to keep people below the poverty line. And I was just thinking about some statistics from an Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander perspective where 8 in 10 or 80% of people had experienced employment restrictions because of their disability in terms of hours or that they could work, the type of work, or when they need time off because of their health. And I think also the other thing that we were just touching on was, you know, how a person's disability support pension can be impacted by their partner. We also know for women with disability, and in particular First Nations women with disability, they're very susceptible to domestic violence as well. So if it adds another layer of discrimination, but also a lack of freedom for people, if we continue to do that, women with disability who were trying to escape a situation of domestic violence are less able to do so because they've got less economic means to escape that situation. It was just another issue that I wanted to throw into the mix there while we were talking about income support. Thanks, Raf.
Gary, let's hear your voice.
Thank you. Such fantastic points to Neil and Daryl. I think one thing that needs to be addressed is problematic narrative that people with disability don't want to work and it's somewhat easier to stay on income support, which we know is completely untrue. And I think we need to recognise the multiple barriers that people with disability face in terms of gaining employment. There is a lot of discrimination. We know that employers are often reluctant to employ people with disability. Sometimes there is fear there. And though we have a Discrimination Act, those type of microaggressions are very hard to identify, and it's not necessarily a pathway that people will want to pursue when they're just trying to live day to day. So I think there's that element. And I also think when we think of economic justice and the people in justice and the people that experience this, they often live in areas that are not very ideal. So, for instance, we know that only 1% of the rental market is affordable if you are on income support. And generally those houses are in areas that are far away from transport, that are far away from an opportunity to engage with employment, for instance. So those type of circumstances can create a dependence on income support, and that that dependence is not something that people with disability want.
Yep, now that's actually extremely true. And from the Economic Justice for People with Disabilities Blueprint, like, these recommendations are the next government must increase payment rates to recognise the actual cost of living with disability, remove barriers that stop people from working, accept permanent disability doesn't need to be repeatedly proven, recognise people's autonomy by no longer tying payments to partners' incomes, and take steps to increase access for culturally and linguistically diverse people, First Nations people, and people in remote areas by improving communication and removing barriers. Now, we're actually going to have to wrap this up because we are fast running out of time for a half-hour show. So I'd like to thank Sherry. Thank you, Sherry.
Thank you so much for your time today. It's been a pleasure to be here.
Thank you, Tennille.
Thanks so much, Raf. It was such a pleasure to be here and we're so grateful for the time.
And Daryl, thank you very much for your time.
Thanks, Raf. Really appreciate the opportunity to have this conversation.
Well, look, I'd like to say thank you very much to Sherry, Tennille and Daryl for taking the time out of their busy schedules. And if their schedules all happen to synchronize, I really would like to invite all of you back to have a discussion about employment, which is a big part of the Justice Blueprint, and for housing, which will be available as a podcast. Thank you for joining me today on 3CR 855 AM Radical Radio on the 16th of July. Let's go out with a song and keep listening to 3CR, because if you don't believe the revolution has started, you've been listening to the wrong station. Thank you.